There we go, Will Young and the Hopes and Fears. Now it's time to welcome back to Phoenix FM Studios the Anton Deck of the wheel making industry. Jan Appfield and Nick Goldberg from Affinity Wheels. I don't know who's Ant and who's Deck. You can choose that. You'll have to come in. You'll have to come in closer than that. Now, having looked at Will Trust and Lifetime Trust in some detail, I think that today you're going to be looking at the ins and outs of establishing a lifetime asset trust. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, Scott. And on the topic of Ant and Deck, I think only one of us would qualify in that age range, to be honest with you, and it isn't me.
Well, don't worry, it's radio, so nobody can actually see, so it doesn't really matter. Now, I think it's only fair to say that this is quite a complex subject, so we can only really skate in the surface. But if you have any particular issues, your best option is always to call the guys at Affinity, who will gladly arrange to come and have a chat. Who knows, Ant and Deck might turn up and provide you with options best suited for your personal circumstances. And we'll give you the number a little bit later on. Anyway, perhaps first of all, you could remind us briefly what a lifetime trust is intended to do.
And I've got to try and keep this simple, haven't I?
Well, it's always a good idea to keep it simple. I mean, with people like me, you know, I've got to have things explained in sort of literally one syllable, you know.
And that's the way I was brought up, Scott, so we're on the same page.
This is Dan, incidentally, everybody.
Right. Well, in short, a trust allows somebody to ring-fence assets for a period of time. Typically, that might be up to 125 years, so that those assets can be protected, not just for your children, but also for your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. And in effect, a trust operates like a safe deposit box, and you can add assets like property and money at any time, subject to certain limits. Mm-hmm. And it can also be fully reversible. So if you change your mind, you can turn everything back to how it was before the trust existed. Although I have to say that if you think you might need to do that, it might not be worth setting up the trust in the first place. We're very careful about establishing that at the front end.
Right. So people-wise, what does the trust actually consist of?
Well, people-wise, there are, let's say, three categories of people involved in setting up a trust. The person that's physically placing the assets into the trust, setting the trust up, is called the settlor. And they can be either a single person or it can be typically a husband and wife. And then a trust has trustees. They're the ones who hold and manage the trust property, and there are typically between two and four trustees. And the trust also has one or more beneficiaries. And a settlor, that's the person once again setting up the trust, can also be a trustee, and of course can also be a beneficiary of that trust whilst they are still alive.
But I think you were saying earlier that if it's a husband and wife, they'd probably be better off having two trusts.
In many cases, that could be true. Absolutely, yes.
And right now I'm talking to Dan Appfield and Nick Goldberg from Affinity. And just before the break, we started to look at what makes up a lifetime trust. And we started out by saying that the trust is of a kind of deposit box. So how does this work in practice, Dan?
Well, assets that somebody wants to control and protect are transferred, basically, to the trust. Gifted to the trust is perhaps a nice way of terming it. One thing they're not is they're not sold to the trust. That's a common misconception. At the point of transfer, the trust would obviously already have been set up. Now, putting the property in trust usually means transferring the ownership from the settlor to the trustee or the trustees, and the trustees then hold the property for the beneficiaries on the terms set out in the trust.
But the settlor can also be a trustee.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Very, very
and
common.
And a beneficiary as well.
But yeah. Very common for a settlor to be a trustee and to also give themselves a benefit from the trust while they're still alive, because we're talking about a particular type of lifetime trust here, which is largely aimed at protecting the family home.
Okay.
Now, usually the terms of the beneficiary's enjoyment of the assets in the trust is determined when the trust is initially established. From the point of transfer onwards, the trustees will have the legal title to the trust property, and if we're talking about a property, that would mean them actually appearing on the title deeds to that property.
Nah.
And to a certain extent, you could say that the settlor is losing an element of control. But if you've got carefully chosen trustees, people that you trust, and of course, as you've already...
It had to be.
well, we're talking about children here.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
We know how interesting relationships with children can be from time to time.
Mm.
The settlor would, we recommend that the settlor also names himself or mm-hmm. themselves, if it's a couple, as trustees also, because it's important peace of mind, I think, for the settlor to know that they can hire and fire trustees. And therefore, if you have a dissenting child who doesn't want to enter into the spirit of the arrangement, shall we say, then it's within the settlor's capability to have them legally removed
right,
as a trustee. Absolutely. I think that's an important peace of mind. And that does need to be built in at mm-hmm. the outset, but, as I say, very, very important peace of mind. For most purposes, once those assets are transferred to the trust, the law looks at them as if they were now being owned by the trustees. And in some cases, where a trust is generating income, if people put liquid funds into a trust, for instance, then it may mean that that trust needs a taxpayer identification number. It may need to be registered with the revenue.
But how can it generate an income?
Well, if you were to put a large sum of money into a trust and the trustees controlling that money decide to invest it, there could be investment income. And in some cases where the settlor is no longer able to live alone,
mm-hmm.
Then it's not uncommon for the trustees, once that property is vacated, mm-hmm. the settlor may at that point be in some sort of long-term care, then it's not uncommon for the trustees to rent the property. So now, of course, the trust will have a rental income.
Oh, right.
And, of course, if you're generating rental income, then there could be a tax return to be completed. So just back to the ownership. Trustees, they are the legal owners of the property, but they're sort of nominee owners for the ultimate beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
The trust, in a similar way to a limited company, has its own life and separate existence, if you like.
It's a
light-hearted way of explaining that. Once the trust has been created, you can use it to ring-fence assets, and most people, as we've already said, will use this type of trust initially to protect their home and sometimes their savings as well. They would need to leave some available working capital in immediately available, of course, for day-to-day living and bills, and income from savings protected within the trust can be paid directly back to the settlor into their current account to supplement their earnings or supplement their pension income, of course. And just like a safety deposit box, assets can be added and removed during the settlor's lifetime. Large expenses that might crop up that can't be met from normal income, things like a new car, which we all deserve from time to time,
absolutely,
holiday, which we deserve even more so, or things like house repairs, all of those things can be withdrawn. The funds can be withdrawn from a trust to cover those purchases. If you are, if you've put a property into a trust, you are termed as the former owner, you would normally set the trust up to give you guaranteed rights of occupation for the remainder of your life. And the trustees, I think this is an extremely important point, they can't evict you from that trust property in any circumstances.
And neither can the local council. Now, I know that the law can change, but it would be very difficult, would it not, to make the law retrospective in a case like this?
Trust law is very rarely applied retrospectively. Mm-hmm. If you look back at the lifetime of trusts, they've been around now for probably 900 or more years. Trust law does evolve, Scott, and it does change. But it's quite rare for it to be retrospectively applied.
What about other benefits?
Well, there's a good one probably to bring Nick in for other benefits. What do you think?
Benefits of a lifetime trust.
Yes.
In what respect then?
Can you get a little bit closer in there, Nick?
Yeah. Sorry, Scott.
Sorry?
Well, you know, when we're talking to people about the need for a lifetime trust or the desire to set up a lifetime trust, we talk about some of the benefits, like probate probably leads us into to a nice benefit, doesn't it? The ability to be able to circumvent the trust assets, circumventing the probate process.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, the reason a lot of people use the trust to deal with probate is because if the trust is set up during your lifetime and the asset is conveyed into the trust during your lifetime, then there's no need for probate on that asset when you die because it's already been transferred out of your name. So that's a good reason.
And probate costs money, yeah?
Probate costs money. Probate takes time,
yeah.
And probate can lead to other issues as well. But yeah, I mean, if people can deal with that while they're alive, while they're well, and when there's no emotion in the subjects, and a lot of people like to deal with that, so that it makes things easier for the children, the beneficiaries. Another example, and Dan picked me there, of course, because I popped out of the room, so he knew I didn't know what he was talking about. Thanks for that, Nick.
He's doing very well for you.
For example, a big one we see is remarriage after the death of one of the settlors, yeah?
Yes.
So, for example, you've got perhaps your parents, while they're alive, they're married, they're happy. One dies. The survivor, as life does happen, meets someone else.
Yep.
Now, we've seen it, and we have many a client who's unfortunately been through this, where they have remarried, you know, but I'm sure it wasn't something that was on their mind, it just happened. Either half of the property or all of the property was in their name,
yep,
at the point of the marriage. And at a later date, they've perhaps realised that maybe that wasn't what they should have done. Maybe it was a rebound marriage in terms of they were emotional.
Right.
They needed to be with someone, perhaps. And we get a lot of people come to us and say, look, you know, we're now looking at the other side of it. We want to get divorced. What can we do to protect the asset?
Hmm.
Now, the answer is, I'm afraid, if they already had that property in trust before they'd got married,
yes,
in fact, before they'd sort of moved in with a person, it would have been protected against that person. Whereas, after the event, unfortunately, it's going to be included, and chances are they're going to lose some of that value to the new partner. And that's the way it goes. Same with, of course, if one of their children was to inherit the value, absolutely. So the value just passes into their names, and then one of the children is going through a bad relationship experience. Their partner can now take off that child. Whereas, again, if it was in the trust already, there is a protection for that beneficiary. So hopefully that was what you meant, Dan.
It is, and just to expand on that, of course, given the current divorce rate,
yes,
amongst the aunt and deck generation, shall we call it? Because that's not yours and mine, Scott. No. But
bit late for me.
I mean, divorce rate, of course, is running now at 50% or thereabouts. It's quite high. I often smile at my own situation because I'm 41 years married, and I like to think I've set a good example in that respect. My wife would just say I'm lazy, of course, but I've got three children. I've got one divorced, one separated,
yes,
and one with three kids by two different women. That's the way of the world nowadays.
Yeah.
And if you want to protect what you have for, not as we said earlier, not just for your children, but for your grandchildren as well, you don't want your estate necessarily going sideways.
Sure,
and we do actually use that term, sideways disinheritance.
You were going to
pounce in with a question there.
No. I was going to add in that I think I'm also right in saying that once the trust has been set up, A, it can't be challenged. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a good point, because if you look at a will, of course, we'll probably cover challenges to wills in one of our talks this year. Unfortunately, in an increasingly litigious society, no win, no fee, etc., we've seen a sharp increase in people challenging wills.
Yeah.
And I think some of them may see it as an easy buck, something that they feel they should have benefited from, but perhaps haven't benefited either at all, or to the extent that they feel they deserve. And because you've removed the asset from your estate before you've died, it's no longer part of the estate covered by the will.
Right.
And therefore, if the will is challenged, they're not challenging what's in the trust, because that's already gone before you've passed away. So that's really where that comment comes
now,
from.
We also talked about the savings that you can make in probate, but you can also make savings, can you not, in inheritance tax, because if it's in the trust, it's a different ball game.
This type of trust, the trust that we're presently referring to, would not benefit the settlor's inheritance tax position. It's neutral insofar as it neither improves nor worsens the settlor's inheritance tax position. However, if you were to pick an example where you have a child, one of your children or one or more of your children, is already of independent means, shall we say, and they have a fairly sizable estate, if you leave your assets to those children in the wrong way, and Nick has already referred to this term, if you leave it to them absolutely,
yes,
what you're then doing is you're aggregating your estate with their estate, which means that if they had pick some figures. If they had 600,000 and you leave them 200,000, that 800,000 now is over the tax threshold. Whereas if you leave it via the trust, it means that we can avoid the succession, the generational tax.
Well, you're effectively giving them the use of your nil rate band, the inheritance tax allowance, Scott. So it's a good way of being able to manage tax issues. We call that sort of inheritance tax a generational inheritance tax. It's one that people don't think of. In other words, they don't have an issue, but they're passing on an issue to the next generation.
I'll tell you what is interesting. We very often meet people whose parents are still alive.
Yep.
And if we're sitting down with somebody who is either at or borderline or over the inheritance tax threshold, of course, we do a family tree to identify what future inheritance that they could benefit from.
Right.
And we very often find that the client we're sitting with is due to inherit, which will compound their problem. And so it's an opportunity for us to float the idea of their parent or parents taking some effective advice to avoid this generational tax issue.
We said it was complicated at the beginning. Dan Atville and Nick Goldberg from Affinity have been outlining some of the benefits of having a lifetime trust. And we've been looking, as we said, at some of the benefits a trust can provide. But presumably, I could avoid some of the problems in setting up a trust by, for example, gifting my home to my children. Could I not?
Well, you could, and we...
But. I can hear the but.
Yes, there is a but, and we, believe it or not, we do come across this quite often where somebody has done this historically. Nick, very often when he's with people, talks about the difference between ownership and control, and it's probably not a bad point at which to bring Nick in to talk about owning something as opposed to controlling it, Nick.
Okay, Dan. Okay, well, look, so the I guess one of the big issues we spoke earlier about remarriage after death, and we talked about if someone dies and they're perhaps joint owners, now the surviving partner owns all the property. Uh-huh. Notice the word owns in there, so they own all the property. They meet a new partner, they get married, and after within a certain amount of time, and unless they've put some sort of prenup perhaps in place, that new husband or wife has a claim against the asset. Mm-hmm. In fact, if they didn't change their will, the new husband or wife would probably get most of the asset if that person died before them. So that's ownership, and of course what you own is what can be up for someone making a claim against, be it social services if you have to go into care. Creditors can make a claim against what you own if you stop paying credit or you get into debt, and of course a partner in the event of divorce. A lot of people suggest, well, okay, why don't I just give it to the kids, because that will resolve the situation. Not necessary, I'm afraid. We like to talk about ownership as a bit of a hot potato, perhaps, yeah? So the ownership, the risk implied of it, the liability, perhaps, is burning our hands. And so we pass the hot potato over to our family members, the children. Mm. And, of course, that hot potato doesn't all of a sudden become cold. It's still a hot potato. So, for example, and let's use a couple of examples. Let's say, for example, we've got a son and daughter. They're both married, and certainly happily married at the time that we give them our property. So we gift them the property while they're alive, so now it's in their names. Quick issue that may be an issue if they own their own properties and they don't live with us. Mm-hmm. Well, then there's a potential capital gains tax issue from the point of time when we give them the property to the point of time when we die and they sell that property, because, of course, it's not their main residence and it's not our property anymore, yeah? But that aside, look, if one of our children was to die, so, premature death, well, actually, if their will was leaving what they own to their husband or wife, chances are we could find that a non-blood family member now owns half of our house.
Right.
Perhaps not what we intended when we gave that asset to our children. If our son or daughter got into debt, then we could have creditors coming after that house. Because, again, remember, it's not our house at this point. It's part of our children's estate. The last one, and again, these are just... I'll do two more, actually. If our children were to get divorced, let's say our son had a failed relationship with his wife. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, his wife could make a claim against his half of our old house. Not necessarily what we assumed was going to happen. Sure. When we gave this property to our son. And of course, perhaps if our son did, say our son passed on before his wife, and he had children, but his wife then remarried, well, mm-hmm. actually, we could find that perhaps our grandchildren don't get what we thought they would get, because, again, it's not ours anymore. We've given it away to someone else, and it's theirs to do whatever they want to do with, yeah? By using a trust, we still retain that control. So, for example, we can give the property into the trust for the benefit of ourselves and then the benefit of our children. If one of our children gets divorced, well, actually, their partner's not going to be able to get to the house that we're living in, which is in the trust, because it's not our child's house. If our son prematurely predeceases his wife, it doesn't automatically pass to her. Those rights can be preserved for the benefit of the grandchildren. So you retain control if you've set up a trust correctly, whereas if you give away the property, then you're giving away the ownership and you're giving away the control to a third party.
Okay, so if that's the case, why don't more people set up trusts, as you suggest?
Well, we use a common phrase. It's a maxim of law, and we use a Latin version of it. So I'll say the Latin. I'm sure Dan's going to say the English, and this is probably very poor Latin, so I apologise. Ignorantia juris non excusat.
Well, you will know what that means.
Oh, of course,
well,
I do.
People do know what this means.
Of course, I do.
You've often heard the term "ignorance is no excuse."
Oh, yeah.
And the literal translation is "ignorance of the law excuses no one."
Yeah.
And so, I think most people don't set these up because they don't know they can. Is that fair? That's probably one of the biggest reasons.
One of the biggest things we find is that people don't know the difference between owning something and they don't understand what trusts do. I mean, bearing in mind, trusts have been about for certainly over 800 years. Most normal people don't have much knowledge about what trusts can do and certainly how they can be used by them. You know, they sort of assume that these are things reserved for the wealthy.
Well, I seem to recall in one of your the earlier programmes that we did that you alluded to this and suggested that although, yes, you could save a lot of money in the long term, it was the upfront cost which could be a bit of a thing that could put people off. Is that right?
That's with all planning, to be fair. I mean, whatever planning you do, whether it's a will or powers of attorney, trusts, a upfront cost puts off a lot of people. I mean, look,
hear how complicated it can be.
Absolutely, and a lot of people we see will pay for their funeral plans up front. Now, of course, you know, the idea and the intention behind that is that if they pay for their funeral plan now, they can secure a rate as of today, which is, I guess, inflation-proof. Some people will put it off, and of course, when the costs go higher, you know, it's a natural thing, isn't it? Most things go up rather than going down. We don't see too much go down these days.
Okay, but you know what's coming next, don't you? Because by accepting that everyone's circumstances are different, and is it still possible for you to give a rough idea of the cost of establishing a trust? I mean, I don't know whether it's an individual set fee per case or a percentage of the estate. How does it work?
Well, it's more, we certainly don't work on percentages. It's everything we do certainly is done on a set fee basis. But the trust we've been talking about, the Lifetime Trust, has a number of variables that can affect the setup costs. And these include things like whether the property is already registered at the land registry, whether there's a mortgage on it, whether it's leasehold or freehold, or whether you need one trust or whether you need two. So, unfortunately, as you would expect, Scott, there's not an easy answer to the question. But
I didn't expect an easy answer, but I thought I'd put you on the spot.
And we often don't mind that, being put on the spot. But I think that going back to the point that Nick made earlier is that what you're basically doing is you're investing now.
Yes.
To save
later.
And that later might not be until you die. We're great believers in looking at the value that the setup cost gives you, and some people will see that value, and it's fair to say that some people won't see that value or won't feel inclined, and they'll leave the problem. I mean, Nick talked about the hot potato. Some people are perfectly happy to pass the hot potato to the children at such time. It's like we say emergency reaction, don't we? Controlled advanced planning, in the overall scheme of things, is going to be far less cost to you and to your family than waiting until there's a problem and trying to deal with it at that time.
Okay.
Now, that's as good an answer as you're going to get on that.
That's fair enough. Look, thanks again for all that you've said. And as we said at the outset, there are so many variables available. And in a programme like this, we can but scratch the surface. So my advice to you is that you pick up the phone and call the guys at Affinity, who will be delighted to give you a free consultation in your own home, where you'll be able to talk through your particular circumstances and sort out something which is tailor-made to your requirements. And the number for Affinity is 01245 85 00. That's a Chelmsford number. It's 01245 85 00. Actually, I think there's an extra O. I think I've missed one off.
That was right. 85 00 00.
It is. Yes, oh, yeah. Right. Okay, fine. Anyway, you're going to be back with us on the 16th of March. So,
2 weeks.
Have you any idea what you're going to be talking about then? Or have I thrown another fastball with topspin at you?
No, not at all. I think we need a rest, I think, from the complications of trusts. And we like to talk about powers of attorney, a mental capacity.
Powers of attorney and mental capacity.
The two go hand in glove.
Don't talk about mine, for goodness sake. Right, okay, well, we should look forward to that. Thanks very much indeed once more.